Clem's not.
I'm opening a meeting of the House Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee on Tuesday, March 14th, 2017. Just by the by, we are expecting other members. Rep. Reschke has an excused absence, and the others will be humiliated when they come in. So, anyway, today the committee is delighted to invite our friends from Colorado back to share the work that they've been doing around workforce partnerships and alignment. This follows up with some of the hearings that we had about a month ago. We're really looking at Oregon's workforce system and had hoped to have Stephanie and Jeff in a little sooner. And we do believe the technical issues we experienced last week should not occur again. And my understanding is the audio is clear, but the volume is pretty quiet. So it may be even harder for the audience here to hear, but a little bit quiet even on this end. So we're going to give it a try. And if it doesn't work, we do have a plan B in mind. We may have to stand at ease. But anyway, Stephanie and Vic, and excuse me. I'm opening an informational hearing. We have Jeff Wasden, president of Colorado Business Roundtable, and Stephanie Vec, director of Colorado Workforce Development Council. Thank you so much for your patience with us and for agreeing to come back and give it a second try. We can't tell you how much we appreciate that, and looking forward to you, what you have to share with us.
Well, thank you so much again, Representative Reardon. It's great to be back and share a little bit. As I kind of launched into the discussion, are you guys okay?
Perfect.
Pretty.
I don't even know if they can
me.
See me. I'm really? Seeing like they can see me. Can they see us there?
We can. Yeah, we're curious. Can you see us?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. Uh oh.
You jazz hands.
Your hair looks very nice today, Jeff.
So where's the speaker?
I didn't hear.
Yeah, maybe if you get just a little closer to the mic and give it your best teacher voice, that'd be great.
Well, I'm going to pick it up. My remarks will be very brief as we get started today, but the Business Roundtable in D.C., certainly in Colorado and across the nation, understands that really the workforce talent pipeline, the investment in human capital, is really the challenge of our lifetime. It's so critical, and it's great to see business and industry finally recognize that. I was kind of thinking as I was driving over here, the old mindset of, we don't care, just get them to us, and we'll figure out how to train them and work with them and acclimate them to our culture. Those days are gone, and I think people realize this competitive environment that we're in and the skill shortage and the gap there. You know, we've got 11 plus million unemployed, 3.9 million jobs, one of the stats I'm using here. It's not that we don't have workers, it's that they're not trained, equipped with the right skills necessary. And too long we've had college readiness, career readiness used interchangeably. And I think you're seeing a lot of things, and the champion sitting right next to me, Stephanie, that's really gonna pick up the torch here in a second, understand that. I'm gonna start to talk very quickly about a couple bills that set this table. So when we had chatted on the phone, we had referenced Senate Bill 14205, and that was really kind of the initial ground that really crystallized, moralized, put into statute that the Talent Pipeline Working Group had a viable function, that it was mandated in statute to really start to talk about the needs of industry, to start to ensure a reporting of the talent pipeline, some accountability on that, and certainly with the sector partnership that Stephanie's going to handle. From there, the last 2 years, we've had a series of working groups. We had 14 bills in 2018, 10 bills in 2016, so 23 bills in the last year, all tied into workforce development. They didn't all pass, but they attacked critical areas like veterans and how we reintegrate veterans back into the workforce, technology integration, recruitment, training, economic incentives, apprenticeship, pilot programs like the IBM Tech program. Now. And so, here, as we talk about a bit.
Are you here? You guys hearing that okay?
We're losing audio.
Hey, Jeff? Jeff?
Go ahead.
The audio is fading out. I'd like to stand at recess just for a moment, see if we can go to plan B. Okay. And here, I'm struggling. My hearing isn't very good anyway, former shop teacher and all. So let's stand at recess. We'll try to hook up on a phone line.
I muted my Skype, so I think if you unmute yours, we will be able to still do video but be on the phone.
Talk radio.
They have to turn off their system.
Civil defense drill or something here.
That'll be the next interruption. We'll have a fire drill and everyone in the basement.
Is that seriously a fire drill? Oh my God.
Hey.
Save yourself.
Another day in house.
You want to call us when you get back?
Where else can you get?
We are muted. You guys need to mute.
Okay. Oh. And if anybody has their phones on, maybe turn those off just in case there's interference. I don't know.
Maybe we should just text back and forth.
Packages came forth dealing with important issues, veterans, technology integration, recruitment, training, economic incentives, apprenticeships, some pilot programs. We've been starting to put those into play, and Stephanie's going to really pick up from there. My final words are related to the Business Roundtable, our investment in the Western Pathways Conference, which I know was of interest. This is obviously strikes to the very core of what we're talking about on the call today. And I, being a former educator, I can kind of poke fun at our industry that I think they have as many conferences as any other industry out there. But they're talking to the choir, and they get together and they do some amazing work and have some great speakers, but they've forgotten the critical components of the three-legged stool to bring business and industry to the table, and then to bring the public sector agencies, the elected officials, the decision makers there. And so the Western Pathways Conference is designed to piggyback on the state team framework that really, I think, it has a more impactful way to move the needle, more significant, more transformational, with a collaboration from the three different legs of that stool that come together. And we'll get more into that in the Q&A session. I really want to get you guys time with Stephanie to talk about career-wise and skillful in some of the programs and work she's doing. So with that, I'll be quiet. Let Stephanie pick it up from here.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff.
Yep. Yeah, you're good, Jeff.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Reardon, and everyone for having us back and dealing with the technology. I know that last week my peer in Oregon, Todd Nail, was in the audience. I'm not sure if Todd is able to be there.
He's sitting here.
Oh, great. Yeah. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Stephanie.
So I just wanted to highlight a couple partnerships. So we have reached out to Todd, and he is willing to lead an Oregon State team to come to Colorado for the Western Pathways Conference, should you all be able to figure out how to do that with the travel ban and other issues that you're dealing with. And I will be leading the Colorado team along with the president of one of our universities here in Colorado. So we look forward to the possibility of doing that. I also want to just share with you the list of links that I sent last week, and I know are up on your sharing site so that everyone can see those. Just want to refer to those. There is, when we talk about our Colorado's cross-agency system and collaboration with the Senate Bill 14205 that Jeff referred to, which put into place our collaborative talent development system in Colorado, we really used our sector strategies and our career pathway strategies that you all heard a lot about last week from your presenters. And I just wanted to point out that one of the links I provided to you is the NextGenSectorPartnerships.com link. That is a national link that was created in partnership between the state of Colorado and the state of Oregon with national subject matter experts. And so that toolbox that's available for every state to duplicate and copy the sector's work and career pathways work that Oregon and Colorado has been doing wouldn't be possible without the partnership that we've had with Todd and his team and the great work that they're doing there in Oregon. So I really want to focus on, I gave you links to our Sector Summit website, to the Next Gen website, and to our Talent Pipeline report, as well as to Talent Found, which is our branding campaign for how to better align the various systems across the state and to increase access to those systems. So I'm not going to go into the weeds on those, but I really did want to emphasize that, as you all heard last week, there is a lot of good work already happening in Oregon. You have the foundation. Through the conversation that we've had in some prep calls, I think what we realized is that you don't necessarily have the structure that empowers an entity, such as your state workforce board, which is how it is in Colorado, to be charged with the convening and coordinating of all of the various systems and partners that must come together and collaborate in a really meaningful way with business. And that's what 14205 did for Colorado. We already used our state workforce board, my organization, the Workforce Development Council, as that convener and coordinator, but the legislation crystallized it, and it crystallized the strategies of sector partnerships and career pathways as the way we are creating industry-led systems in Colorado to meet industry's needs for workforce. As a result of that foundation that we laid in 2014 through that legislation, and we carried out through our 21 sector partnerships and our multiple career pathways, we also have launched a couple very innovative programs that is built on that foundation. One Jeff referred to as Skillful. Skillful is actually a national initiative. It's an initiative of the Markle Foundation. And so if you go to skillful.com, you'll see the website that's up there. It's a partnership between the Markle Foundation and LinkedIn, and they chose to use the state of Colorado and the city of Phoenix as their test cases for this platform because of the alignment work that we had done in ensuring that there is a consistent way for economic development, workforce development, training, education, and higher education to work in partnership with business, where business becomes an equal partner, not just a customer, and business actually becomes a producer of talent, not just a consumer of talent. So Skillful is one of those initiatives that resulted out of that cross-agency framework that we've been able to build. The other, and
before you get in real quick, Representative Reardon, we believe that Alan Blue, the co-founder of LinkedIn, and Zoe Baird, the CEO and president of the Markle Foundation, will both be present and presenting at Western Pathway. So just wanted to let you guys know that that's the kind of caliber of CEOs and presidents and programs that we're looking to highlight in that program, along with several governors.
Great point. I believe they're very excited to try to figure out how to make sure that they're here for it. So the other, and I believe this is the presentation that Representative Reardon saw myself and Noel Ginsberg, the founder of CareerWise Colorado, present on at the Reach Higher event in Colorado Springs last summer that really sparked a lot of interest in the work that we're doing. CareerWise Colorado is our youth apprenticeship program that is built off of the foundation of our industry-led sector partnership and brings intentional work-based learning strategies to our career pathways work. We took a trip to Switzerland last year, and I think I provided these links for you, but just in case I didn't, I'll state them now. If you go to YouTube and you search on YouTube Colorado's Bold Move and Colorado's Tomorrow's Talent Today, we'll bring up two videos. One is a summary of the trip to Switzerland, where we really looked at how we need to change the way we are educating Coloradans through work-based learning and through a partnership with business. That was done in January of 2016. The Tomorrow's Talent for Today video was when we launched CareerWise Colorado as a formal organization, nonprofit organization, in September of this year. And those videos will give you a good insight into that work, as well as the links that I provided that'll show you all of the work we're doing. In addition to that work, we also have established a work-based learning unit within Colorado's Department of Labor and Employment to charge them with ensuring consistency of our work-based learning programs, everything from career awareness and job shadowing, internships, paid internships, pre-apprenticeships, clear through full-blown apprenticeships, and convening and coordinating that work. So our council, the Colorado Workforce Development Council, in partnership with the Governor's Business Experiential Learning Commission, has taken that framework that came out of 2014 and launched CareerWise Colorado, the Work-Based Learning Unit, and also the Denver Opportunity Youth Initiative, which is a partnership with the Denver Metro Chamber of Commerce for opportunity youth. So out-of-school young adults, 16 to 24 years old. So we're really looking at this as a comprehensive model, and we can send you all of the information that you would like, but I just would stress that I don't think we could have done any of it without having a single organization charged with talent development and the convening and coordinating, not running programs, not actually doing the work that education, higher education, workforce, and economic development does, but being the impartial third-party convener of that. And it seemed to me in the conversation and the research that I've done that although you have many boards and councils focused on talent development or workforce development or education or some combination of those, it doesn't seem to me that your structure really provides for a single point that's responsible for that convening and coordinating of those systems. And that's what we got out of the 14205. So.
Yeah, let me interrupt just for a minute, and for the sake of the committee as well. I've always thought it wise to copy the best work that I could find. So I have actually been working on your bill, on the Colorado bill, to do the same thing. I just dropped it Monday and met with the our legislative council. So it's a work in process. We have to make some tweaks to make it appropriate for Oregon, but that will be coming to our committee soon, I hope. So.
Great.
Well, congratulations on that. And I can't, you know, minimize or over discount the work that's done by setting up the proper legislative structure, right? It takes that kind of, as Stephanie mentioned, crystallizing it, putting it in statute, putting it in writing, and mandating there that every organization needs to come to the table with the understanding of Stephanie and her committee's role to convene, to deliver, to be the central clearinghouse for all things workforce. From my standpoint, where I am with the Colorado Business Roundtable, it's very easy. If there's a program out there, we were just talking about a new biz ed coalition kicking off Thursday, I just have one person that I need to talk to, and it's Stephanie. I don't have to chase 15 different organizations. I go to Stephanie, who understands the umbrella of the organizations and how that's structured. The caution, of course, is, you know, the mandating of reporting requirements and time. At some point, you know, we ran 23 different bills, several of those passed. It puts a burden on some of the departments and certainly Stephanie. And so, you know, I think we're all trying to say, can we have a workforce timeout and let's catch up and actually see if these programs are meeting the smell test and are actually producing the kind of results we want before we start overlaying those with other bills. And so, you know, we're really looking at some time to evaluate the types of programs that are being ran there and measure those and be able to come back and do some reporting on the success of before we start launching into others.
Have any questions or comments as we're going along? So, okay.
Just a quick question.
Oh, quick. We do have a question.
thank you for the presentation so far. Just curious, you obviously worked with the state. Did you find, in this work, did you find that you ended up, that the state itself had to increase capacity to be able to make all the great work happen?
So every state is different, and what I would say is with 205 in Colorado, it did not require additional capacity for that specific piece of legislation. all of the work that came out of that collaboration, building CareerWise Colorado, creating our work-based learning unit. We have a piece of legislation that charges us with creating two new career pathways every year forever. And all of those absolutely required additional capacity to implement them. And so it is important to recognize that a certain amount of the convening and coordinating work can be done as part of the existing jobs of state employees, and in some cases even local employees, local staff. But the really deep programs like CareerWise, Skillful, and the Career Pathways work takes additional capacity.
Thank you.
Other questions or? Oh. Who's waiting for who?
Representative Reardon, as you guys are kind of formulating questions, I do want to take a second and thank you, Todd and others in your state. I think it's important to recognize your willingness to get engaged in this process, to look at ways that you can improve opportunities and pathways for all students within the state of Oregon. I think you are all to be commended for that. Stephanie knows that Todd and others are doing some amazing work in Oregon. The structure that was put into place actually, I think, is your biggest piece, and the thing that will help Oregon the most is to give it that structure and framework and understand the flow chart, the responsibility, the accountability of the program that will help you guys, because you've got all of the pieces in place. I think you just need that one last component, which again, as Stephanie mentioned, you will not need additional capacity from there. It's when you start that where all this starts to then spin and spiral, sometimes out of control, but in a good way.
Well, thank you, but I will say we did not need additional capacity. I started with a team of 5 people. I don't believe Todd's staff is that size. So every state is different. We have responsibility for the governor's reserve, and we are funded by a pool that comes from 5 different state agencies that all chip into our operating budget that does not come from the governor's reserve. I don't know how Oregon works, but that is something that if you're going to task any organization, whether it's your OWIB or another organization, it will be important to look at their existing capacity and additional capacity to take on more work.
Yes, it's always good to recognize the capacity of the staff, especially when they're sitting in the audience. I wanted to just check. Do you have more to your presentation? I felt like I sort of interrupted you, and I wanted to see if you had anything else before we continue the dialogue.
No, I think that was I just wanted to hit the high points and be available to answer questions. So I've discussed everything that I need to, unless you have questions.
No, I think I'd like to invite Todd up if he's willing. Would you like to comment, join us?
Sure.
And I'm hoping, as far as our structure goes and a bill that we've dropped, I'm planning to do that without any more than with barely any fiscal. The only concern I have is we have a talent council that needs to be, there's a planning element of that that has to, needs to be continued. It needs to be part of this process. It needs to be the work that helps keep us focused on going forward. So, you know, that'll be part of it. You know, how that is funded. It's funded for 1 year as we speak, and need to continue that. So that'll be an issue, but other than that, I'm hoping to do it with existing resources as well. But we have to get the bill dropped to see, you know, what really happens. But very optimistic. I've been working with the agencies, and so it's so far it's looking very, very positive. But Todd, if you'd like to introduce yourself and any comments you might want to make,
Sure. Chair Reardon, members of the committee, my name is Todd Nell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. Recently, we've been having conversations with Chair Reardon and other folks, and I just want to, first off, thank Stephanie so much for being willing to try to present at the last session and come back and present today. Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you, Jeff, for presenting. We really appreciate it and appreciate your time. And again, as I've shared with a number of folks over the last several days, both Chair Reardon and OIB members, Colorado really is looked at on a national basis as a best practice in the workforce system realm, and is oftentimes mentioned in a number of different program areas as being sort of the one to aspire to emulate. So Stephanie's already touched on the great work that they've done in sector partnership work. We, like you, Chair Reardon, like to, as Stephanie calls it, do R&D, or rip off and duplicate. Yeah. We find it much more effective and efficient to meet the needs of both our business and job seekers here in the state of Oregon. And so it felt natural and the right thing to do to partner with Colorado and the esteemed consultants that we did to pull together, as Stephanie said, the Sector Partnership Academy that was down in Arizona recently. I think it was well received across the country on many fronts, both on the business side, agency side, and even some of the economic developers that I talked to when we were at that conference shared with me that it really resonated with them as well. In addition to the sector partnership piece, this component that Stephanie led off with around the Western Pathways Conference, I think, is really key to good, solid sector partnership work. And so we're excited, again, with the caveat that Stephanie already touched on, travel restrictions coming into play, perhaps. Excited, nonetheless, to participate and help lead a group that goes down, which would not only include partners at the state agency level and likely local level across the workforce, education, training system, but also include folks maybe from economic development. We're not quite sure what that looks like, but nonetheless, to get to a point where we do the very best that we can with career pathways in the state of Oregon to achieve our goals.
Great. Any questions for Todd? Okay. Stephanie, Jeff, I think we've completed our questions, and I think it's really been helpful to have you kind of put a point on this effort that we're making, on what you're doing, kind of help us understand better what pathway we might be taking on our journey. But I'm so glad that you're willing to share, and thank you again for being here. So.
Absolutely, and please don't hesitate to reach out if you have any additional questions about any of the specific initiatives or anything else that we're doing.
Okay, thanks again.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm closing the informational hearing. And the next item on today's agenda is public hearing on the University Research Fighting Fund bill. We'll hold scheduled work sessions toward the end of the hearing to give Rep. Reschke a chance to join us. And Laura, would you please, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2582. Now, Laura, would you provide the committee with a brief summary of the bill?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2582, it established University Research Fighting Fund, defines qualifying grants as federal research monies offered to post-secondary institutions on a competitive basis, and with the requirement that post-secondary institutions must provide additional monies from private industry, state, or other sources to receive federal funds.
Welcome, Representative Rayfield. How are you?
A pleasure, Chair Reardon.
Good to have you with us.
And you with me on this exciting bill. So, Chair Reardon, members of the committee, my name is Dan Rayfield, House District 16. I'm here today on behalf of House Bill 2582, and kind of the context behind this is that each year that the federal government gives out large, sizable federal grants in Oregon. And when I talk about large grants, I mean, this could be in terms of, you know, $70 million, money that could potentially come into Oregon. And universities try and compete for these dollars. One of the criteria to compete for these dollars is matching funds. And what we've historically done in the past is universities have gone to the governor's office and sometimes gotten a letter saying, hey, we have some money. We may be able to allocate this money for the matching funds so that this application could be competitive. What we have is a biennial budget, and which creates a problem in really being able to have a firm commitment or letter stating, yes, we have money set aside specifically for this purpose to make us more competitive in for these grants and this money coming in. And this is money that can come in, quite frankly, that within the universities and then can be leveraged for economic development across the state. And so that is what this is about. What it does is it creates a fund to capture some of the basically unspent money that puts it into what we're calling a fighting fund, which is then used, and it's a $20 million fund, which will then be used for this process. It'll be located with HEC, and then they can then allocate the money from there. And so that's why we're coming before you today. I'd also wanted to note I am also thankful for the OSU Cascades bill and look forward to that vote coming up a little later. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Conover.
Good afternoon, Chair Reardon and members of the committee. My name is David Conover. I'm the Vice President for Research and Innovation at the University of Oregon. And thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 2582, which would establish a state fund that will give Oregon's public research universities and its academic medical center an advantage in competing for federal research funds. Let me tell you a little bit about myself and why I'm the one who's here. I came to the University of Oregon just about 7 months ago from Stony Brook University in New York. While I'm a newcomer to the state, I've been involved with federal granting agencies for my entire career. From 2010 to 2013, I was on leave from Stony Brook and served as the director of the Division of Ocean Sciences at the National Science Foundation, which is one of the principal federal agencies that support work at universities. For more than two decades, I was also a member of the faculty at Stony Brook University, which is also a public research university in New York, and I served as the dean of the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences there and as the vice president for research at that university. I couldn't be more pleased to be in Oregon. There is an energy about the technology sector here and a hunger to improve the economy that's very exciting. It's clear to me that Oregon's research universities, the University of Oregon, Oregon State, Oregon Health and Science University, and Portland State, all have a vision and a desire to collaborate with each other and with the state's policymakers. And there have been notable successes in a very competitive research environment that these universities have achieved. Today, I want to talk to you about this bill from the perspective of someone who has worked at a federal agency. And evaluate awards and proposals that come in from universities. I've also been in the position as a VPR of making decisions from the university's viewpoint as to how much matching funds we can put into a proposal to make it more competitive. It's important that as a state we ask ourselves, what can we do to promote our knowledge economy competitiveness against a growing global competition? So first, let's talk about the granting mechanisms of federally sponsored research. As a former NSF official and a VPR, I can tell you it's becoming harder and harder for faculty to win awards, especially large awards, as research funding has been tightening. Make no mistake, this is still an important area of opportunity for universities, and in fact, Oregon's institutions of higher education garnered about $700 million in federal research funds within the past year. So we're talking about lots of federal dollars coming here. The most common type of federal research grant involves individual investigators pursuing a particular research question. These grants typically have a fairly modest matching requirement, if any, and we can typically fulfill that with resources at the university level. But there are also much larger federal research awards that support centers, that support interdisciplinary consortiums, that support multi-university initiatives that are intended to bring much larger sums of money and focus on much more complex problems. And it is those kinds of awards there is expected to be a demonstration of local or regional commitment to the effort that's signified by a cost-sharing arrangement such as matching funds. The Fighting Fund is a way that the state can organize resources to help universities be more competitive. And in competing for these grants, and let me just tell you a little bit more about what the match component of this actually means. We're really talking about federal agencies that are looking for cost sharing on a project. And the more cost sharing they see in a project, the more likely they are to view a competitive proposal favorably. And we're competing with other research institutions and universities that also have cost sharing in their proposals. So it's a very important element of how these are judged. The matching requirement can be as little as 10 or 20%. Sometimes it's 1-to-1. Sometimes it's even more than 1-to-1. And many of these are projects that have innovation or economic development goals as part of their objectives. So it's really these multi-million dollar awards that are focused on major economic development goals and public-private partnerships where the universities of this state need assistance. Let me give you a couple examples. One example of a program is the National Network for Manufacturing Innovation, now known as Manufacturing USA, which is a program run by the U.S. Department of Commerce in consultation with Department of Defense and other agencies. This program awards hundreds of millions of dollars in grants to consortiums of universities and industry partners who accelerate innovation by investing in industrially relevant manufacturing technologies and support manufacturing technology commercialization. Similarly, the U.S. Department of Energy has pioneered efforts to promote innovation with support from public and private partners. When we look around at what other states are doing to help their universities, let me give you some examples of that. It's typical for states to fund research through a variety of means, including direct support, and programs that encourage universities to take certain strategic directions. A study by the Academy of Arts and Sciences found that in 2014, states and local jurisdictions across the country spent $10.5 billion on research, agricultural, and medical education purposes, or about 12.2% of their total support for higher education. Some examples. The state of Massachusetts appropriated $40 million to assist a coalition of universities to successfully compete with MIT as the lead for a $317 million public-private partnership focused on textile and fiber manufacturing. The Florida legislature approved $5 million in annual recurring funds and a $10 million one-time appropriation, which helped the University of Central Florida join the Massachusetts New Smart Fibers for Textiles Consortium. The Clean Energy Fund is a program that the state of Washington runs. The fund provides matching grants covering the spectrum of R&D, including demonstration and commercialization. The programs include clean technology research development and demonstration grants, grid modernization grants, and grants to nonprofit lending institutions to establish loan funds for clean technology businesses and projects. In 2013, the Washington legislature appropriated $76 million for the state's Clean Energy Fund, and last year the legislature approved over $100 million in capital funds to invest in clean energy and energy efficiency development and deployment. And it included $40 million for the Washington State Clean Energy Fund. And an additional $60 million has been requested by Governor Inslee for the upcoming FY17 to 19 budget. So this gives you an idea of the scale of what some of other states that we're competing with are doing. So to conclude, large multi-institutional research competitions are highly competitive. Oregon universities are competing with the likes of MIT, Stanford, Berkeley, Harvard, and other state public institutions around the nation. These are high-risk, high-reward endeavors that will and most will require substantial matching dollars to be successful. Developing these proposals is a huge effort. It's very complex, and they have to be done over a relatively short timeframes that don't permit the legislature to make appropriation decisions on each individual grant, nor would that make sense. Often these grant competitions require confidentiality to ensure that other applicants don't benefit from the premature disclosure of techniques and research methodologies that might be embedded in these proposals. For Oregon to be competitive for these sorts of high-impact grants, we need to put key structures in place in advance that allow universities to rely upon state support while also recognizing that the state has limited resources. The Fighting Fund balances the need for fiduciary control while creating flexibility and encouraging shared responsibility and collaboration among research universities. Establishing a Fighting Fund with HB 2582 would make a significant difference in advancing the competitiveness of Oregon's universities and the industry partners to engage in research and innovation. I urge you to support this bill. Thanks for your time, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay, any questions to these two gentlemen? Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your testimony. $700 million last year was brought in by universities in Oregon. Is that correct?
Yeah, Chair Reardon and Member Johnson.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of money.
What I'd like to see, and it's not inherent in the bill, and I don't know if it was intentionally omitted or not, but what I really need to hear is how this is going to benefit kids.
Well,
universities, first and foremost, are about students. And I get that you'd like to have these great resources to and have for these great research, ambitious research projects and stuff. But at the end of the day, when it comes down to allocating dollars, and you're talking about $20 million here, I need to see how it's going to fit kids in the classroom. And I know it's inherent in the projects that are done, but I'd sure like some at least reference to the intent of asking for $20 million.
Yeah, and Chair Ritten, and Representative Johnson, there's going to be two different levels focusing where the money is going to be emphasized. So, first off, the $20 million, and Mr. Warner is here to explain how that's coming. That's coming from unexpended funds, so we're not currently asking to take money out of the current budget. So, kind of put that off to the side. And so, with that said, I mean that would be taken out of the separately allocated, which you know in theory could be used in other bienniums. What we're really looking at is kind of a long-term vision and what you see kind of in the research triangle in North Carolina. And so on one side of this, what they've been able to do is take the research and actually build up their economy. And if you look at the long-term benefits of actually having jobs and increasing the median incomes in a given state with the research that's being done and the benefits that produces back into the state. And so that's one element. And then there is the in-school side of this. From a university perspective, which Mr. speak to a little bit more directly what he's seeing.
Right. So students are involved in all research projects that take place at the university. Of course, it's primarily undergraduates and graduate students, but there are programs that also where we also bring in students that work on projects with faculty. So there are benefits that accrue to students that result from the research dollars. We're an educational institution, and that actually conducting the research is how people learn to become scientists, the future scientists of the nation.
Yes, please.
What I'd like to see, and it's not necessarily all on your plate, but you know, each of your institutions, the research institutions, have institutional boards now that we created so that they could have the ability to strategically manage their resources and funds and so forth in a more cost-effective manner, but again, to provide benefits back to students. And it just seems hard for me to visualize these other big initiatives at the same point in time we're talking about potentially double-digit tuition increases, you know, for your base kids in the classroom, your undergrad kids and stuff. And I'm not, you know, blaming you at all for that, but it just seems like we're disconnected here. On the one hand, we're aspiring for these grand visions, and I get it, we got to do that. But on the other side, I think we're forgetting about the rank-and-file kids that are just struggling to, you know, try to get a degree.
Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson, these are competing interests when you don't have enough revenue in your state. So I look forward to working with you and your colleagues on getting more revenue in this state so that we can put more money into higher education to reduce tuitions. That's not going to change the need that we have right now to get more research dollars into the state, thinking long term and how do we move forward as a state and what has been in North Carolina is one of the most successful stories about how research dollars in universities can drive economic development. And so I don't see these, you know, and when we have constrained resources, yeah, you're right, they can be competing. However, my vision for Oregon, as I'm sure it is yours, is we look long-term where we aren't competing for resources and we're doing what's best for our long-term outcome here in Oregon. So
I look forward to having that conversation. At the same time, we're talking about reducing some of the cost drivers that are increasing costs exponentially on kids as well. Thank you.
Chair Reardon and Representative Johnson, let me just add one more facet to the educational benefit of research grants. We know that students acquire a certain amount of learning from the classroom, but where they really get deep understanding is through experiential learning that occurs in research laboratories. It is very much part of the fabric of education when students get a research experience with one of our faculty. The grants also provide financial support so that the students could get a summer stipend, for example, by working in a lab. So it also helps them in terms of making their economically making their way through college. So there are a variety of spin-offs that help students from these research grants.
Is it safe to assume that this money, that the grant money that's provided here and any additional grants that are picked up, where would that money be spent?
Well, it's spent, much of it will be paying salaries and benefits for employees that will be here in the state. A lot of materials and supplies will be ordered from vendors in the state. I can't give you a breakdown of exactly how much of it stays in the state and how much of it gets spent outside.
It'd be interesting to know more about the actual, you know, if there's a way to calculate the actual return on investment of this sort of investment other than, you know, smarter, better educated students. But there's also, you have some offsets, and you know, if we're making this investment, you're going to get additional tax dollars, income tax returns to the state and so forth from not only this money but any matching money. So it's not, my fuzzy math says it's not really like spending $20 million, but that's my fuzzy math. So we won't use that. That's why Paul Warner's out here. Okay. Oh, do we have grants in the pipeline right now that would be taking advantage of this? And is this money, is it money that can be used by any of the universities, or how does that work?
Chair Reardon, I'm not aware of any of these major grants that are in the pipeline right now, at least not at the University of Oregon. There might be some at the other three universities. Okay. We have proposals that go in all year round, though, virtually constantly going into the federal agencies, but many of them are of a smaller size.
Now, one last question. Is this money that would need to be replenished every biennium, or?
And Mr. Warner can kind of talk a little bit about the details, but the idea behind it is that there is the initial allocation, and as we become successful with the grants, that money would then draw down and then could be would be replenished at a later date based upon those unexpended funds. But Mr. Warner is here is what I'm told to kind of discuss the details.
All right. Oh, Rep. Warner.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a follow-up to Representative Reardon's question about the funds drawing down, in my mind, if the fund draws down and there's research that perhaps produces some patents, my expectation would be that the revenue from those patents would replenish this fund, and the fund would sustain itself. So this is where I'm thinking. The fund is created with a principal balance, maybe draws down, but at some point becomes self-sustaining. What's the long-term vision of what you're trying to create, and who's leading it? Or is this a seed, and you're trying to figure out how it can grow?
So, Chair Ridden, Representative Bynum, it's not a, this is not a seed that's looking to grow. This is an investment. And then, it very simply put, is if it gets drawn down the way it's currently drafted, is that that would be replenished. So, for instance, if in a biennium we weren't successful with any grants, that money then would sit there. Mm-hmm. To give you a real example, since I've been elected, I've been in the process with the university where we had to get a very waffly letter from, and this is basically saying that, hey, we're going to work to really try and make sure that we have these matching dollars in the best if we can, you know, and it's, and so this really just creates that certainty to make the grant application more competitive so that we can draw down more federal dollars into this state. Yeah, this isn't a fund that we're going to, we have zero plans to come back next biennium, and, well, now we need $100 million, so.
Okay. And Rep. Alonzo Leon.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. So my question is around probably from more the internal system. So we have all these universities who all want to apply for federal grants. In your vision, who would be a priority? How would that work if there's all institutions are applying for X amount of dollars to fulfill the federal application requirement?
So, Chair Representative Alonzo Leon, I'm not the smart person, so that's why we delegated the HEC to be, you know, kind of in control of this and kind of, you know, going to be the, that's where the allocation is made to, and they will establish a process for kind of procuring the funding, you know, once the grants are confirmed.
Okay, we do have four other presenters on this, and do thank you, gentlemen, for sharing this with us, and appreciate your time today. Thank you. Thank you. And we want all four up, you think, or oh, three? I don't count well. Okay, with Dr. Brian Paul. I'm not reading your handwriting or this room. By yourself. Okay. Oh, I read that. Sorry. Okay, so I read this, my note wrong. It wasn't her handwriting.
It was upside down.
Dr. Paul, if you would welcome, and if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record, that would be great.
Certainly. Chair Reardon and committee members, for the record, my name is Brian Paul. I'm a professor at Oregon State University and the Tom and Carmen West Faculty Scholar and Professor of Manufacturing Engineering in Oregon State University's College of Engineering.
Nan, excuse me, let me interrupt just for a second. I managed to allow, we were ahead of schedule, and I managed to get us behind schedule for a bit. So, and we have a couple of other folks behind you, and we need to be done with this part about 4:15. So, if there's a way to speed this up a little bit, that'd be really helpful. Okay. I'm just looking at the two pages, of, and we do have this in front of us, so we can read along.
So, let me kind of continue on here. So, I'm here today on behalf of College of Engineering in support of HB 2582, the Fighting Fund. So Oregon State's College of Engineering is the 11th largest engineering program in the United States. We are home to about 9,000 students, 180 faculty, and significant research enterprise. So we talked about, you know, impact to students. So we serve a great deal of those students in the College of Engineering. The success of our college is due in part to past legislative initiatives through the Engineering Technology Industry Council. Through that support in the past, we've grown our student body by at least 6,000 students and about 80 faculty. and our research expenditures have tripled. One of the questions that was raised a little bit earlier is what do these research efforts kind of go toward? So when I put budgets together for, you know, going after that funding, it's primarily paying for graduate education. I would say a significant proportion of that budget goes to paying tuition and stipend so graduate students can go to school and learn. And then the project becomes the learning experience, as the prior person kind of talked about. Some of the areas that we've done research in and continue to is in, one of them is in advanced manufacturing. And so that's what I'm kind of here to talk about a little bit, is some of the success that we've had around that. So the prior speaker talked about the National Network for Manufacturing Innovation, and also known as Manufacturing USA Network. So we've recently won we've become part of three of those, and two of those we're playing a significant role in. So those, as was mentioned, there's about 14 of those institutes now. We, you know, as a state, participated in four other efforts before the three wins that we got this year. Oregon State played a significant role in being able to move some of those things forward. Key to a successful proposal is garnering broad-based in-kind and financial support. So this year, with the three institutes, one of them was named what I'll call RAPID, the Rapid Advancement of Process Intensification Deployment. It's the 10th Manufacturing USA Institute, $70 million over 5 years. It has about 75 companies and 34 academic institutions, 7 national labs. Especially gratifying for me is that I am one of 6 focus area leaders. So that $70 million has to be matched 2-to-1. The original proposal had a price tag of $334 million on it. Of that, about $30 million will be to my discretion in terms of under an industry-led roadmap of how we administer that moving forward. We would expect OSU is well positioned to be able to capitalize on a fair amount of that. Again, the preponderance of the money there will go to fund graduate education in the College of Engineering at OSU. So those contributions, there's a confirmed in the proposal, there was a letter of support from the state emphasizing 15 years of investment from the state of Oregon that's allowed us to be in the position to win that award and be able to have the ability to control some of those budgets and stuff so that we can advance the students through the research programs. I would say, in addition, there was about a letter of commitment from Business Oregon for about $5 million, and those were based upon investments in Onami and Oregon Best. There's been significant investment by the university through our Advanced Technology and Manufacturing Institute facility down in Corvallis. So why am I here talking about the fighting fund with regard to all that kind of money? So I have an obligation from a nationwide standpoint to spend that money as best directed by my industry board. The more Oregon companies I can get involved with that board, the more that participate on the projects, the more the chance that we have technology advancing within the state. Just to give you some examples of what some of that technology might look like, we've got distributed chemical processing. This would be like for hydrogen for fuel cell cars. Hydrogen that right now basically about 25% less greenhouse gas emission if we build it with some of the chemical process technology that we're able to do. So that's the kind of technology that we would like to be able to see exported to other parts of the world, green technology. But in order for small companies in the state of Oregon to participate, they've got to have cost share. And so that just gives you an example of an idea of how this fund could be used and leveraged in some of those projects to move that forward. So one other thing I want to mention is Carnegie Mellon, who is a national leader in robotics, recently asked Oregon State's advanced robotics program to participate in an $80 million call in a similar manner. So we have also been a part of that team that's won. You know, many universities and industry trade associations that are involved with that, community colleges that are part of, you know, outright not just research but workforce development and talent development kinds of initiatives that are going on in that. The governor provided a letter of support but no matching funds, and in this case, right now in the negotiations of the contract as it's moving forward, they would like to establish these robotics innovation centers, and one of the regional areas would be up here in the Pacific Northwest. And so we're a little bit in a situation where Oregon State University would be in a position to do that, but it's got to be able to have these types of cost share from the state showing commitment to this kind of technology development to be able to have the chance. So fighting fund in that case would give us a chance to get this Northwest Innovation Center and drive, you know, the technology forward within the state as well. So these are just in summary here, just the two examples of opportunities for our students, you know, in the college, in the university, in the state to drive forward technology that can create new jobs. So in this sense, not only are they doing the research and learning how to do research through these kinds of grants, but they end up with, I have examples of students of my own that have gone on in startup companies in Corvallis and other parts of the state moving forward. We appreciate over the past 20 years the leadership that the legislature has demonstrated in meaningful investments in engineering and throughout the state. And so participating in these proposals is really an outgrowth of that leadership and the opportunities that you give us. So a solid next step to build on the opportunities that you've allowed us to get to would be to get this fighting fund to allow us to participate in these big budgets even at a larger level.
Thank you very much. This is a real super complete presentation. We have lots of information here. I'm going to discourage questions in the interest of time. If you're going to blow up or something, let me know. But okay, great. Thank you, Dr. Paul. Very helpful testimony. Appreciate it. Your being here today.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up three people, and so Betsy Earls, Paul Warner, and Edith Rush. And let's see, I'm Betsy. Would you like to lead off, or did you have something planned amongst yourselves?
That would... Mr. Chair, we don't have a plan. I'm sorry to say.
You're on the top of the list.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association, and also appearing before you today on behalf of the rest of the business community that has signed on to a letter of support for this bill that I believe you should have in OLIS, although you will see it in color. It's much more attractive that way. So we are appearing before you in support of House Bill 2582. And our support of the bill is really based on the fact that the grants that you've been hearing about are a vital part of the development of research projects that will support the work of Oregon's manufacturers. The greater the ability of our universities to compete for grants, the greater will be the ability of our manufacturers to compete in a global economy. The return on investment to Oregon of receiving these grants is, as you've heard, quite significant. Federal grants can carry a 4-to-1 ratio for that return on investment. So, as you've also heard, a $5 million state commitment could result in a $20 million multi-year commitment of federal funds. And that's important not just because of the money coming into the state, but also because of the jobs that it drives, the technological advances, and the other benefits that will accrue around that project and in those communities well into the future. We urge your support of 2582, therefore, as a means to strengthen Oregon's economy and our manufacturers. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I'm sorry. Yeah. Edith. Sorry.
Thank you,
Chair. There's too many pieces of paper up here.
Members of the Higher Education Workforce Development Committee. For the record, I'm Edith Roush with Tax Fairness Oregon. I also am a professor emeritus of educational leadership and policy, proud graduate of the University of Oregon's program. This testimony that I'm about to give is probably the most complicated thing I've ever had to prepare. Because quite frankly, I want to be honest with you, everything that these representatives or universities are telling you about grant programs and how states operate them, how universities function, is the absolute truth. Basically, House Bill 2582 is very similar to many requests that you are facing this season, seemingly good ideas that promises revenue-producing results. This is what these kinds of research funds actually do. Yet every fiber of my academic being wants to be supportive of this bill, but we can't figure out where the spare $20 million is in this particular environment. We don't know where it's hiding. I basically am looking at the notion of academic research as a proven engine for state efforts to grow an economy, to solve social problems, and improve educational experiences. And Representative Johnson, I wanted to respond to your question because it struck me that you really are interested. How does this benefit not only the students, but kids in general? I was very much a part of the Gear Up structure, which is a federal grant program in another state. I operated on that for 6 years as a university representative. Just about every dollar that we brought into the state was invested back in middle schools following students for 6 years to actually enhance the college-going population among high-poverty students. So we invested in professional development with teachers. We brought students on campus every summer for math camps, for writing workshops. We did just about everything we could to enhance the capability not only of students to achieve a college degree, but also worked with their families to understand why that would be an important thing to do. So there are amazing benefits to some of these federal grants, in addition to the kinds of science things that you're hearing about, which actually provide major innovations. So I do support that. The thing that I guess struck me about House Bill 2582 was some of the language in it was identical to language that I heard when you revisited the University Venture Development Fund last spring. And as I looked at the notion of this bill targeting grant acquisition, that particular effort actually looks at providing additional monies from private industry, state or other sources to actually create commercially viable products and services. So that language is in both of these bills. And we wondered whether some of the product of the Venture Development Fund couldn't actually become a seed. Right now it looks like that the money that is earned from that, from patents and trademarks, goes into the general fund. So perhaps there's a way to cycle it back into this becoming a seed money. I would agree with the University of Oregon's vice president. You are competing with states that have far more efforts than Oregon has at this point in time. It is not uncommon for there to be four or five different approaches to providing funding support for universities because it is in the best interest of the economic development of the state. Basically, this particular bill, though, right now I'm looking at higher education wanting $100 million more than Governor Brown's budget is authorizing. And so we're wondering if they're actually wanting $120 million more than her budget or whether somehow this $20 million is to be subtracted from the $767 million that the governor is proposing for the appropriation. We also are looking at the tuition increases at this point in time. So Tax Fairness Oregon is taking a position that this type of thing at this juncture point needs to be put on a wish list. It is important. I don't want to deny that at all. But with the budget shortfall that we are facing right now, you are facing some very hard decisions. And I guess I want to echo Representative Rayfield's notion. I think those decisions have to do with revenue. Basically, I cut my teeth in this group back in 1990 when I actually completed my policy class by volunteering in Senator Frank Roberts' office while he tried to figure out, all of you tried to figure out how to fund Measure 5. And he said to me at the time, he said, the only place we have to get the money to fund K-12 the way this measure is set up is from social services and higher education. And higher education went on a precipitous decline in this state right after that. And it only recovers now when you have a healthy economy. I mean, we have a healthy economy. You all have a lot of fun. But you're not facing that kind of decision this year. So I think the revenue piece is absolutely critical, and Tax Fairness Oregon believes that as well, that until we can fundamentally fund a fair and adequate revenue stream that supports the basic needs of our citizens, there are bills like these that have to be put on that wish list. Basically, I would say to you, he told me I had to leave the state if I wanted to go into higher ed, because he said higher ed won't recover from this for decades. And it hasn't. And having worked in three other states across the country, from the East Coast to the Midwest, to my last stint was at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Basically, I would say Oregon's reputation as struggling with funding for higher education to support its university system is well known. I was a part of departments that included higher ed administration, so I had colleagues who were always aware of what was going on across many, many states, and how, you know, everybody has their struggles with higher education. But Oregon's basically situation was oftentimes a case study of struggle for funding, and it has to do with a stable revenue stream. So I thank you for your time.
And thank you. Your message is well received and well understood. Paul, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is your first visit here.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Officer. I was asked to look at some of the mechanics of the transfer mechanism that's envisioned in Section 3 of 2582, and so I'm going to describe that briefly and then encourage you to ask any questions. Basically, what Section 3 does, it refers to ORS 293.146, which was established, and I think many of you recall, in 2007 when the Rainy Day Fund was first put into place. And the Rainy Day Fund receives a transfer from the general fund, ending balance, following each biennium. That transfer is up to 1% of appropriations in the prior biennium. So, and the timing of that mechanism is we wait for usually a six-month period following the end of a biennium for kind of a reconciliation in terms of reversions from state agencies. And by January 1, following a biennium, we're able to look and see what that ending balance is based on, of course, we've been projecting it, but seeing what it is based on the reversions we've got in and the final numbers from the expenditure side, and we've already got the final numbers from the revenue side. If that 1% is there, then it's transferred in January to the Rainy Day Fund. What this bill would do is, following that transfer, it would look to see, first of all, if they're sufficient to meet the 1%. And, for example, to give you some numbers right now, we're projecting $181 million transfer to the Rainy Day Fund in January of 2018 under current law. So that wouldn't be affected by this. The projected ending balance is $348 million. So you'd make the 180 transfer to the Rainy Day Fund. Then you would look to see if there's $20 million after that to make a transfer to the University Fighting Fund under this bill. So that transfer would take place after the Rainy Day Fund transfer occurs. Mm. Typically, as I say, we make projections. We're projecting $348 million now. We do typically have a bigger beginning balance, ending balance from 15-17, bigger beginning balance for 17-19, when we see all the expenditure reversions come in to the general fund. So that's been the pattern. There's no guarantee of that, but that's been the pattern. What this bill would do, if, for example, the ending balance were less than $180 million, less than the 1%, then there would be no transfer to the University Finding Fund. If it were $10 million above the $180 million, then the transfer would be $10 million, be up to the amount, up to $20 million, depending on what the balance in the University Fund is. So that's the mechanism and how it would work.
And if we don't take this $20 million, there's just no other use for it? Or?
Mr. Chair, you know as well as I, there's always uses for things in this building. That would, if under current law, that beginning balance is adjusted as you go into the next biennium. Yeah. So that would, if it's not committed, then it would fall into the ending balance for 17-19, and okay, it would be an available resource. Okay. So yes, it would be available. So there's, it doesn't, it's not something that appears out of thin air.
Rep. Fulman.
Thank you, Chair. I may require more information on this than what's processing through my brain, because you're saying that that if that does not get spent, that it goes to the to 17-19 to be used within, and you're saying the $181 million would get used, but the balance is $348 million.
That's correct.
Okay.
So
I want to make sure I had that. Yeah.
Yes, Representative Solomon, Mr. Chair. So what we're looking at now, let's say the $348 million is that projection is correct, and that's the number we're looking at in January of next year. You take $180 of that and put it in the rainy day fund, and then the remainder of that, which would be about $168 million, would be available for to go to the ending balance. Under this bill, $20 million of that would go to the university fund, mm-hmm, and then the remainder would go to the ending balance.
Okay. Hello. Interesting. Real quick,
okay,
please.
No, I'll just follow up later.
All right. That's great. Okay. Any other questions? We're kind of, again, okay. Thank you all for being here today. Thank you. Appreciate that. And I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2582. Okay. That's exciting. Would you mind being the guy on the Cascades?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate it. Oh, wrong one.
So he's doing the tech. He was meditating there.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm sure. Get the heck go ahead of you.
Okay.
You're excited.
No problem. I'm ready.
Okay.
I'm on the bench ready. Put me in the game.
Okay. Members, we have two bills ready to go for work sessions today. Then the HEC statutory cleanup bill and the OSU Cascades expansion bill. We're going to start holding work sessions more often as bills are increasingly ready to be worked. And so I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2314. Laura, would you give us a reminder of what that bill is about?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2314 would allow Higher Education Coordinating Commission to set minimum standards for graduation from cosmetology schools by rule, requires HEC to approve public university mission statements, and to approve apprenticeship training credit. Expands Aspire program financial aid and post-secondary options instruction to middle school and college students, authorizes HEC to enter into contracts and agreements with public and private entities for certain higher education and workforce development activities, directs HEC to transfer interest-earning monies from Oregon Student Assistance Fund to the Oregon Community Foundation for investment, updates statutory references to the General Educational Development Test, and replaces executive director title with director for HEC Office of Student Access and Completion. There is a -3 amendment posted on OLIS members that specifies rulemaking must include minimum hourly and student proficiency-based training requirements standards. It deletes sections 11 through 13, which require transfer of interest-earning financial aid monies to Oregon Community Foundation, and declares emergency effective on passage. The bill has minimal fiscal impact, minimal revenue impact, and there's no subsequent committee referral.
Okay, I would entertain a motion on the dash three.
Chair Reardon, I move to adopt the dash three amendment dated 2/16/2017.
Rep. Alonzo Leon moves to adopt the dash three amendment dated 2/16/2017. Is there any discussion?
I have one question.
Rep. Whitman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was the amendment worked with the stakeholders and there's no opposition to the bill?
To my knowledge, that's true.
Thank you.
Yes. Or maybe there's other comments on that. So, Rep. Johnson.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. To answer Rep. Wisner's question, now there was quite a bit of back and forth with the stakeholders, and my understanding, everybody's in a good position as of this time.
Okay, I'm sorry, I can't.
Yeah, I couldn't.
Okay. We're okay. That's what I thought. Everybody went off huddled up.
Reassuring him.
Good.
Very
thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one clarification, kind of along the lines of what was just discussed. The amendment includes the representation of the proficiency-based programs, and they were the ones that weren't getting representation in the conversations. And so the intent here is to make sure that they have representation on the minimum standards as that's being coordinated.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Just want to be clear about that.
Okay. further discussion? No. Any objections? If not, the amendment is adopted. Okay.
Chair Reardon, I move HB 2314 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Rep. Alonzo Leon moves House Bill 2314 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
We did move the amendment. I didn't hear that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. We did. That was what you did.
Yeah. Seeing none, the clerk will call a roll.
Representative Bynum?
Aye.
Representative Clem?
Excuse.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Reschke?
Aye.
Representative Solman?
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion passes. And Rep. Johnson, would you like to carry this?
No,
you
carry.
Thank you very much. Okay, I am closing a work session on House Bill 2314. And I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2782. Laura, would you please provide a little summary of that?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2782 would authorize State Treasurer to issue bonds under Article 11G of Oregon Constitution in amount not to exceed $15 million, and authorizes State Treasurer to issue bonds under Article 11Q of the Oregon Constitution in amount not to exceed $54,490,000. Allows monies to be used for site reclamation and restoration, campus infrastructure construction and renovation, Academic Building 2 construction, Student Success Center construction, and Graduate and Research Center renovation projects. The paperwork is in order for a work session, and there's a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Any comments?
Chair Reardon, I move House Bill 2782 to the floor of a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay, Rep. Wisnant moves House Bill 2782 to the floor of a due pass recommendation, and be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Rep. Reschke.
Thank you,
and
Mr.
thank
Chair.
You for joining us.
You bet.
Just in time for
for
the
important, you know, for the voting. Right, exactly. So I'm going to vote aye on this, but I'm going to just so we can move it to Ways and Means. But I'm going to reserve the right to vote no on the floor.
Absolutely, and okay. Appreciate your discussing that ahead of time too.
There you go.
I want to say a couple of things.
Okay, go ahead.
I just wanted to say I really think this is a great policy. I'm totally supportive of it. I want to remind it, though, that we are the policy committee, and Ways and Means have to make the hard decisions. But this means so much for Eastern Oregon, the Bend area. We had fantastic presentations that, you know, they talked about what this means to the economic growth in Eastern Oregon. And also for access to people over there. I'm still struck by the 41-year-old mom who was working, who had a chance to finish her college degree because of that campus. And also remind members, this isn't just a new idea. This has been something that's been in the works since about 2001, which I hadn't realized myself. So also just for the record, it has also been sworn to me many times. This is outside the HEC list that HEC puts together. It's above and beyond that. And so with those words, I would
like to thank Mr. Chair to have a couple. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank the committee members for your work on this bill. It is very valuable to the economic development and also other benefits in Central Oregon. I've been here since 2003. It started the OSU Cascade started in 2001, and we've had a lot of uphill fights, but we're getting close. And with this passing of this bill, and we're going to build this university out in Central Oregon and for Eastern Oregon people. And appreciate the chair's leadership on this and all the committee members' support of this bill. And I'll be babysitting it through the Ways and Means Education and full committee for the committee. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So, there's no further discussion, and clerk will call the roll.
Representative Biner?
Aye.
Representative Kuhn?
Is it absent?
Representative Burt?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Okay.
Representative Reschke?
Aye.
Representative
Solomon?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Lanzione?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wissett?
Aye.
Chair Reardon?
Aye. Thank you, everybody, for your involvement in this. It's really important work. It's going to be one more thing we look back on fondly, I think. So I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2782, and I'm closing a meeting of the House Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee. We are early. All right. We are early. All right.